It's 106. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, the recession has created a new economy, and we're going to talk about that this hour with David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter who also teaches business, tax, and property law at Syracuse University College of Law. David Johnston, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn program.
Well, thank you for having me, but I always use my middle name because there's another investigative reporter named David Johnston.
Ah, noted. So the Great Recession, I don't know what was so great about it. It was big, I guess, in that context.
It was big.
The recession, capital R, changed the game, and you say changed it forever. The headlines have said, hey, we got all those jobs back, and then the subtext of that is, but it didn't really matter. Let's talk about that. People are worse off coming out of this recession than they were coming out of the Great Depression of the 1930s. What is so different this time around?
Well, you have to look at this on a relative basis. I mean, overall, we are much wealthier today than we were in the 1930s. But the Great Recession officially ended on March 31st, 1933. And a lot of people think it went on and on after that. But the next 40-some months were one of the greatest periods of economic expansion in American history, and then we went into a second fallback in the economy. And in the period from 1933 to 1936, the average income of the bottom 90% of Americans went up by almost a third. It went up 31%, John, and that was a gain of over $2,000. So what happened in the 3 years after the Great Recession ended in June 30th, 2009, over the next 3 years? Well, the bottom 90%, their income this time went down by about 2% or $566 on average. So coming out of the Great Depression, there was a huge comeback for people. And coming out of this era, no, we're seeing the exact opposite. And the gains are being highly concentrated at the top. Of the increased income from 2009 to 2012 in the country, there was some increased income. Almost a third of it went to just 16,000 households. That's the 1% of the 1%. 95% of it went to the top 1% of Americans. That's everybody who makes over about $360,000. And so I think we need to recognize that this is a very different recovery than we had back 70-plus, virtually 80 years ago.
Let's just talk about why that is. Is this a result of the difference, for example? There probably isn't just one result, but is one factor here the difference in tax policy between, say, 1933 and 2012?
Well, there are a lot of factors at work. Taxes are one important element of this. Back then, the income tax did not apply to the vast majority of Americans. Today, it does. But what's also different is that today, large corporations, particularly multinationals, and very wealthy Americans are legally able to live tax-free. And in the case of multinational corporations, they literally turn a profit off their taxes. And I've written numerous pieces showing how this works. But essentially, if you can delay paying your taxes for 30 years, any tax lawyer will tell you that's the functional equivalent of not having to pay the tax if you invest the money. And that's what we have going on. These massive deferrals at the top, I was part of my best-selling series of books on the American economy, is explaining these mechanisms. So tax policy is part of it. A second big element of it is the massive subsidies that we are giving at the top. We are giving a subsidy to the too big to fail banks that is larger than the food stamp subsidy. And of course, food stamps are there for people who don't have other income or have an income that's inadequate for a proper diet. There's no reason for us to be giving $83 billion a year in subsidies to the too big to fail banks. As some economists at the IMF calculated in Bloomberg News, which has done a very good job of documenting the costs of these government programs for the banks, has shown. And then we have trade policies that are sending jobs offshore and a variety of other policies.
What form do these subsidies to the banks take?
Well, we allow through this policy of the Fed, the very big banks, to borrow money from the federal government through its outsourced currency agency, the Federal Reserve, at virtually zero interest, less than 1%. And then they take this money they borrow and they buy U.S. government debt that pays several percentage points of interest. And the net result is they make a benefit off this arbitrage between the two numbers. At the same time that we're doing that, we have not provided relief to homeowners. And even if you didn't take out one of these toxic mortgages, even if you were, whether you were talked into it by a slick salesman or you were, in fact, trying to game the system, if you had nothing to do with that, you've still been impacted by this because housing prices overall came down. And so people who had paid off houses or conventional mortgages and behaved perfectly well have also paid a price for this. And we've had lots of things we could have done for those homeowners, and we've done very, very little.
Well, I guess most people would assume, wrongly, as it turns out, that the money that's being borrowed from the Fed is supposed to be turned around and loaned out to people to buy houses or to increase production at factories or hire workers or invest in some other business purpose. But that's not what's happening.
That's right. And you're exactly right. That's what people would assume. Just like, you know, back in 2004, we had this tax holiday for corporations that had transferred profits out of the U.S. to offshore so that they could delay paying the taxes. We let them bring back the money and pay not the 35% corporate tax, but 5.25%. That's an 85% discount on their taxes. I've never gotten an 85% discount, John. I suspect you haven't either.
No, I have not.
And what the research showed was the biggest beneficiary of this, the drug company Pfizer, instead of creating jobs, it was called the American Jobs Creation Act, they proceeded to fire 40,000 people as soon as they brought the money back. And that overall, most of the money that was brought back from offshore was used to buy up company stock, which, of course, by creating an artificial market, pushes up the price of the stock, and the executives who have options, therefore, can collect on their options. Very little of it went into anything that would be job-creating directly.
So, and I don't want to spend the entire hour on tax policy, but this is such a key piece of this. There's really very little incentive for in the tax code for anybody to actually hire workers. If you take a look at, say, the tax policies of, say, 50 years ago, companies were owned differently in those. There were a lot more companies that were, say, family-owned or individually-owned, not as many large multinational corporations. But the way the taxes were set up, you were better off hiring more workers and producing more stuff than you were trying to just turn around and swap that money with somebody else to make more money because of the way taxes were paid, and that's no longer the case.
Yes, but finance used to be roughly 15 to in the low 20% of all corporate profits in America. Figure $1 in $5 of corporate profits or less. In one recent year, it was over 50%, and it's typically running now in the mid-40s. So we've doubled the size of the finance sector, and we've reduced the size of these others. Now, one of the big important changes that's taken place is the massive reduction in the corporate tax rate. So imagine you own a company, and the corporate tax rate on profits is 50%. And at the end of the year, you suddenly discover you made more profit than you thought, an extra $10 million. Well, you're very likely, if it's a 50% profit, to say, well, you know, I think it's time for us to do some reinvesting. We're going to rebuild assembly line number 2, and we're going to put a new roof on one of the warehouses, and we're going to buy some new trucks because, in effect, the government will pick up 50% of the cost and push that tax bill off into the future. But if the tax rate is lower, if the real tax rate is not the 35% posted rate, but you're actually paying more on the order of 15 or 20%, you're more likely to say, let's take the money out of the company. And when you withdraw capital from a company, you are destroying jobs. Now throw in this multinational effect. We do have to compete on a worldwide basis in the new economy. But if you can literally earn a profit off your taxes, as the big multinationals all do, then you have a totally different set of incentives, and they're not good for jobs. And to the extent that you need to create jobs, you're going to say, wow, maybe I can do that in China or Vietnam, where we're seeing the job growth.
On the other hand, you also have on the demand side of the equation, with fewer people making a decent living, with people making less money than they had before, they have less money to spend on the kinds of products and things that get produced. And so there's a disincentive to produce more stuff if you can't sell what you already have in inventory. Isn't that also the case?
It is and it isn't. It is true that we have less ability to buy. The average income of the bottom 90% of Americans, that's about 280 million of us, inflation adjusted, has fallen back to the level of 1966. Lyndon Johnson was president. The news referred to China as red. Mustangs were brand new cars in those days. But if you're a multinational company, if you can sell your goods all around the world, then the loss of demand in the U.S. gets made up for by demand elsewhere around the world. But if you're a purely domestic company, a mom-and-pop shop of some kind, then, yes, this poses for you real problems, but you don't have the political power. 81% of all the business assets of all 6 million American companies are owned by less than 2,800 of those companies. And they're the ones that have enormous political influence, and they're the reason our tax code is so bloated. It's not because of you and me and the people listening to this show, for the most part. It's because of favors sought and bought by this industry and that industry and this wealthy individual who get little things planted in the tax code that they can exploit.
We're talking with David K. Johnston about the new economy. The headline says we have recovered the 8.7 million jobs lost in the Great Recession, but the subheadline is it doesn't really matter. At least that's what the headline is in the Huffington Post Business Report and elsewhere. And we're talking about some of the differences between the recovery from this recession and the Great Depression of the 1930s. Following the 1929 crash, we came out of that. We were better off then than we are now. We're discussing that and welcome your participation in this as well. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave a comment or question there. When we come back, I want to refocus our attention on the job situation and talk about where the job growth has been. We restored those 8.7 million jobs. Where were they, and how does that compare to what we have had previously? And then also talk a little bit about the pool of employees, of employable people. What's happening with that? Are we keeping up with population growth in terms of job growth? All that to come as we continue our discussion with David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He teaches business, tax, and property law of the ancient world at Syracuse University College of Law and stays with us the rest of the hour. You can join us. Please do. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about the new post-recession economy. The Great Recession ended officially in 2009, so why don't we feel like we're doing better? We're discussing why that is and why, when we compare how people are doing today compared to when we came out of the Great Depression, we're not doing as well as we did then. My guest, David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He teaches business, tax, and property law of the ancient world at Syracuse University of Law. David K. Johnston, we've seen some jobs recovered. We got back the 8.7 million lost in the Great Recession, but it isn't enough. Where's the job growth been in this recovery?
Well, interestingly, it's not in government. During the Reagan recovery after the recession in 81, there was an enormous explosion of government jobs. The federal government under the current administration has been shedding jobs, and so have the states. A lot of the growth that's taking place is in health care. That's going to continue because we have an aging population in this country. The boomers are, some of them are now eligible for Social Security. So that's going to continue to be an area of growth. We're not going to see much growth. We've seen some growth in manufacturing, but we're not going to see much because in manufacturing, new techniques allow you to do more work with fewer people. I was just out on the Oregon coast, and there's a lumber mill there where I remember going into lumber mills in the 60s where there were hundreds of men at work. This lumber mill requires 8 people, one of whom works in the office, because it's all automated. And you mentioned before the break, population growth. We are back to the number of jobs we had at the time that the Great Recession began in 2008, but we need, because of population growth, about 7 million more jobs. So when you look at things like wages per capita, they're down because we have fewer workers and a larger population. And if you look at wages per hour, one of the reasons we feel worse off is the average wage in this country, inflation adjusted, was higher in 1972 and 1973 than it is today. It was about 6% higher. So back then, you could earn by the end of the first week of December the amount of money that you now would have to work until December 31st to earn if you're at the average wage.
Okay, so what is it going to take to bring back some middle-class job growth that we had seen coming out of World War II, for example?
Well, I think one of the most important things it's going to take is for us to get in line with our economic competitors and bring back unions. The General Douglas MacArthur, whose staff wrote the Constitution of Japan that we imposed on them after World War II, with the express purpose of creating a society that would be more less unequal and therefore less bellicose, required unions. And so Japan is heavily unionized. All of our European competitors are unionized, and in Germany, executives have unions unless they are at the very top level of executives. Australia, New Zealand, Canada, all heavily unionized. The unions represent bargaining power. Unions mean that workers as a group can gain information and can negotiate for reasonable pay. With the system we have now, where only about 6.5% of private production workers belong to unions, means that we think that individuals going up in many cases against multi-billion-dollar organizations, they could be nonprofit, for-profit, or government, have any idea what they're worth or any bargaining power, and they don't. And so that's a critical element in this. And the founders in 1792 passed a law that required a prototype of modern collective bargaining. I wrote about this in Newsweek a few months ago in an article called Why Thomas Jefferson Favored Profit Sharing. So I think one of the key elements, John, is we've got to somehow figure out how to get back bargaining power for workers if we're going to have general improvement. Secondly, we've got to stop doing these trade deals, which have nothing to do with free trade. They are focused instead on maximizing the profits for the companies that are promoting these, and that's why they're all done in secret. You know, President Obama wants what's called fast-track authority to run through without changes the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership and the proposed TAFTA or Atlantic Trade Agreement. And we've seen, because WikiLeaks leaked part of it, one chapter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Chapter QQ, which tells you that there are at least 40 chapters. That chapter is 30,000 words long. It has nothing to do with tariffs and trade barriers. It is instead to protect the intellectual property rights of companies and do things like, you know, Walt Disney died a long time ago, but Congress keeps extending the Disney Corporation's intellectual property rights to Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck instead of letting them expire. It's the equivalent of, imagine if you had to pay Shakespeare's family a royalty today if you wanted to put on a play and that prevented you from writing something off of that, like Tom Stoppard's famous play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. You wouldn't be allowed to do that under the kinds of language that are in the proposed language that is in the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Hmm. We've got some callers who want to join the discussion. Let's get to that. Let's get to those callers. Let's go first to Rhinelander, where Ray is on the phone. Ray, thanks for joining us.
Yes, let's cut to the chase here. Back when the Depression started, the original one with FDR, okay, first of all, he did not bail out banks and reward the greed that was going on then. And if you study history, you can break that down and see exactly what happened. Also, the country was being rebuilt in-house in America extensively, and jobs were created, opportunities were created. As where now, jobs, etc., are exported out of the country because of the greed for profits and profit sharing, etc., etc. So make the comparison, make the parallel, people, and see the difference. If I'm wrong, I would like your presenter today to explain this further. Thank you, and I'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks, Ray. David K. Johnston, I think you'd probably agree with most of what he had to say.
Well, except for the fact that the Great Depression started in 1929, FDR didn't take office until March of 1933. Other than that, in good part, he's correct. I mean, what we did in the Great Depression was instead of funneling money to businesses and particularly propping up banks, we had all sorts of programs to create jobs. We had the National Recovery Act, which was held to be unconstitutional. We had the Works Progress Administration. The government went out and hired artists, and we built buildings. I mean, look around America at how many buildings the federal government financed in the 1930s that are still around today, rock solid. The town I grew up in California, there was a discussion about tearing down the high school that was built during that period, and they discovered it was so solidly built that it would cost more to tear it down than to go buy new land and build a new high school, second high school in town, which is what happened, and I went to the second high school. The government, you can make a very good argument that the entire federal government has been captured. One of the principles of regulatory law, and by teaching the ancient world's regulatory law, I'm trying to get students at Syracuse to understand the principles of how we got to the law today. One of the widely held views in regulatory law that arose in the 50s and 60s was what's called capture, that you and I don't pay any attention to what the Wisconsin Public Service Commission does on utility rates, but the utility companies sure do, and they work to get that agency to operate as much as they can for their benefit, not in a balanced way for the benefit of customers and the company. And I think you can make a fairly compelling argument with over 100,000 people employed to influence Washington and the state capitals that we have capture of the federal government and its policies. The polls show, for example, very broad support for the kinds of things that FDR did in the 1930s, and yet they're not on the agenda at all in Washington.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's the number to call to join the program, as Mike has done from Castle Rock. Mike, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I agree with everything you've said. I think it's a little more complex. Also, what's the end game here? I don't see anything that you've mentioned going to be taken up in the next 2 years. And maybe the next president either. I don't see any way out of that, this at all. And so I'd like to ask, what's next? You know,
okay. That's a very good question. I have actually a book out that talks a lot about this. It's been out for 2 months, called Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. I'm not the author. I'm the editor. It's an anthology, and it's got everybody from Adam Smith from the 18th century to Senator Elizabeth Warren. Great social change in America generally comes from the bottom, not from the top, and it takes time. Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, one a woman who never married, the other the mother of 8 children, devoted their entire adult lives to getting back the right to vote for women. There were people who spent their entire lives trying to get rid of the awful institution of slavery practiced in this country. We got child labor laws and other changes, but it takes a long time. And movements have to arise that people focus on. Unfortunately, we live in a society now where a lot of people get paid to put barriers to change and are paid very, very well for this. And at the other end, people are trying so hard to work and their incomes have been cut that their capacity to organize and undertake reform takes time. But look at how quickly the issue of gay marriage changed. We can have pretty rapid change once something coalesces out there. And I'm not an organizer. I'm not a politician. So I'm a journalist, and my job is to describe these things. But I think that we can have pretty rapid change once the public gets away from, oh, we can't do anything, to let's get organized and start demanding things. Let's vote people out of office. Let's vote in new people. Let's get campaign finance laws that do not turn our Congress and our state legislatures into hired organizations that benefit the political donor class, but that benefit all Americans.
One of the things that a previous caller brought up, and I wanted to touch on as a big difference between now and, say, 1934, right now, it seems sometimes to some people, from what I've been reading, that the entire country is organized around the purpose of creating shareholder wealth, and that is the highest benefit that anyone can achieve is to create more shareholder wealth. That wasn't necessarily the case. In fact, it wasn't the case in 1934. Is that one of the big differences? We're just really focused not only that, but on current quarter thinking, even corporations, the people who work in corporations who'd like to do strategic planning can't even do it because they're captured by the current 13 weeks.
Right. This is a really serious problem. And the New York Times, my newspaper I worked for many years, is partly to blame for this. First of all, this idea that the purpose of a corporation is to maximize shareholder value and that's the duty of the directors of a company, that's just not true. It's what Milton Friedman said. Milton Friedman was an economist, a brilliant economist, but he was not a lawyer. The law says that the directors of a company's duty is to take care of the entity, the corporation, which, after all, has no soul, no mind, and no independent capacity. It's like a baby, and their duty is to take care of it. And Friedman wrote an article in the New York Times Magazine in 1971 or 1970 in which he made this argument, and it went unchallenged. If you want to understand it, there's a 9-minute video I did when I was with Reuters with Professor Lynn Stout, who teaches at Cornell University and used to teach at UCLA. She is a Republican market-based lawyer who teaches corporate law and has written a book about this. But that's a real problem, this misunderstanding of a corporation and what it's supposed to do. And also the fact that the founders of this country were very suspicious of corporations. There were only a handful of corporations in existence created domestically in the late 1800s when this country was founded. And corporations used to be for single purposes for limited periods of time, not what they are now, existing in perpetuity for any purpose that those in control of it want to use it for. I think we need to have some revision and reform of our corporate laws to reflect how to get the benefits of corporations so we have people take risks and invest and grow the economy, but we don't do what we're doing now, which is these massive subsidies to companies all over the place with, many of them, the big ones, as I mentioned earlier, profit off taxes. We have one big industry, the biggest private infrastructure owner in America, the oil and gas pipeline industry, that you are forced to pay its corporate income taxes. In fact, what's called the grossed-up corporate income tax, it's much higher than the regular tax rate, and yet they are exempt from the corporate income tax. But we are forced by regulation under the previous administration to pay their taxes, and they just keep the money. Actually, the managers keep the money, not even the investors. And so we need to have a serious discussion about the role of corporations and the rules governing corporations in modern America so that they don't rule us, but they serve us.
And, of course, aren't most of these companies incorporated? I mean, it's state law that allows the creation of these corporations, isn't it? Or am I misunderstanding
No, that's exactly right. And in the early days of the 19th century, when corporate formation took off, there was a race to the bottom. New Jersey at the time was the state that had the loosest rules. Today, depending on your structure, it tends to be Delaware, Florida. In Wyoming, you can create a corporation, and they will provide you with a board of directors so you can hide yourself. The former Panamanian ambassador to the U.S., Eduardo Moran, points out that if you're a terrorist who wants to conduct an operation to damage the United States, nothing will help you more than the laws of Nevada and Wyoming in creating a corporation, hiding your identity, moving money around so that you can conduct your activity. And, of course, once you've done it, it's over. But the secrecy that we allow in these state laws is very troubling. There is a little house with a nicely trimmed lawn almost within sight of the state capitol in Wyoming, in Cheyenne, that is, at least on paper, the home to something like 4,000 corporations.
Wow. Let's take another call. Let's go to Jim in Beaver Dam next. Jim, hello.
Hello there. See, I'm dairy farmer, cash grain producer here up in northern Dodge County, and we've been led to believe ever since NAFTA was passed, going back to some of these free trade agreements, that it's been a savior, you could say, for the agricultural community. You've disputed the free trade agreements. I tend to not agree with them either, but what effect does that have on agriculture, or is it strictly a benefit for the major players? Say, I'll pick on Archer Daniels Midland as a grain commodity trader in a world market. Many farmers feel that without the free trade, our commodities would not be competitive in the world market. Is that true?
Well, this is a very complicated and difficult issue. Overall, what's happened under NAFTA is that our trade with Mexico has gone through the roof, but our trade deficit has expanded much faster than that is, the trade has been very one-sided. It's been Mexico beneficial. The same thing under our agreement with South Korea. After it took effect, we were told both sides would be better off. Well, for every dollar of our increased exports of goods and services to South Korea, they are sending $25 worth of goods and services to America. Our ability to export various grains has certainly been a boon to the economy, but you have to look at things like the subsidies we provide in the eight grain states in the Midwest. If you take those subsidies and just remove them from the official data, all the farm profits in the Midwest disappear. They distort the economy. And, well, it's one thing to have protections for farmers against things like bad weather. Hammurabi's Code, almost 4,000 years ago, had a form of protection for farmers and ranchers. The students get it in their first lecture on the history of business regulation at Syracuse Law and the business school at Syracuse. That's very different from what we do now in the U.S., So the effects of NAFTA have been very mixed. And by the way, those apply mostly to big business. If you want to move to Canada, try and take your car to Canada. You will discover you can technically do it, but it is such a nightmare, it's not worth it. Sell your car, buy a new one in Canada. But if you're a car dealer, if you're a car manufacturer, you'll have no trouble at all moving cars across the border. The same thing with jobs. You can move capital under NAFTA's rules across the borders of the three countries very easily. Jobs? No. These are therefore not even deals. They are asymmetrical, and everywhere you have something asymmetrical, where you favor, in this case, capital over labor in the rules, then you'll have exploitation of those rules to the detriment of the group that cannot move, namely the workers.
Jim, thanks so much for that call. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we have more callers and pages of questions and things to talk about. I think we could easily do a couple of hours on this topic, David K. Johnston, but we'll have to try and pack as much as we can into the next 16 minutes or so. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back with more with David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter who teaches business tax and property law of the ancient world at Syracuse University College of Law. I'm John Munson, and for Kathleen Dunn, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Kathleen Dunn Program. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. We're talking about our recovery from the Great Recession and how, well, it doesn't feel like much of a recovery for a lot of us because even though we recovered 8.7 million jobs, we really needed another 6 or 7 million to keep up with population growth, and the jobs that we have gotten back have been for more low-paying occupations like things in the hospitality sector or something part-time. Middle class is shrinking. We're talking about the reasons for that. It's a pretty wide-ranging discussion. And my guest is David K. Johnston, who has been explaining some of the details of this. And it's a very complex topic, very difficult to cover in an hour. We're kind of doing our best here, and we'll continue to do so through the end of the program. One more quick tax question. I had an email from Bob in Stinnett who suggests that what we really need to do is to get rid of corporate taxes entirely, but tax capital gains as ordinary income, and that would help fix this problem. David K. Johnston, what do you think of that idea?
Well, I have repeatedly urged that we undertake a very thorough study of whether we should get rid of the corporate income tax. Before the two Reagan tax cuts, 1981 and 1986, the Treasury Department did huge studies called Treasury 1 and Treasury 2, and FDR's administration also did huge studies, all of which show that you have to think of the tax system as being like a game of pickup sticks. You move one stick, the whole dynamic of the pile can shift in ways that you don't predict. So if we're going to eliminate the corporate income tax, we can't just eliminate it. There are a whole bunch of things we have to do. We have to have rules to make sure they don't become bloated tax shelters. We have to get rid of this rule that encourages corporations to hold untaxed cash offshore. But I think that fundamentally we should really examine taxing everything as what's called a flow-through corporation. The corporate income tax, by and large, in terms of revenue, applies to about 15,000 companies. They're most of the money. We also need to have more auditing under the current system. Most senior IRS corporate auditors make $150,000 a year, and on average they find over $19 million of taxes that are due. Now, anybody with a business who can hire a salesman for $150,000 who brings in almost $20 million is going to say, where can I get more? Not Congress. They have been eliminating these jobs and handcuffing these auditors.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones and hear from Pete in La Crosse next. Pete, good afternoon.
Hi, John and David. I'm not too far off topic here, but there was a Great Depression, or at least previously called the Great Depression, in the United States from about 1876 to 1893, and it was subsequently renamed the Long Depression. And out of that, we got robber barons and maybe some other things that seem to me, because of my limited knowledge of history, correspond to today's Great Recession. Perhaps David can talk about things that came out of that era that may be similar to what we're going through today in terms of changes.
Well, that's actually a very good insight. There were a series of what were back then called panics, and sometimes now we refer to them as the Long Depression. There were falling prices, and the creation of industrial knowledge, the ability to make steel very efficiently instead of having to stand there with a hammer and pound carbon into iron, things like that, led to the creation of fortunes the likes of which the world had never seen. John D. Rockefeller, who was a very efficient businessman who understood that safety made him money because then his product didn't get burned up and his refineries didn't blow up, they created fortunes, just immense fortunes, and it led to these huge distortions because neither the tax nor the regulatory system had a way to see to it that the benefits of this were return to people in relationship to their contribution to the creation of those fortunes. And yes, we're living very much in a similar age in that our economic policies operate on the assumption that if you're an owner, everything that the company makes, you're entitled to without thinking about that there are rules that benefit you at the expense of small vendors, of local governments, of individual workers if they don't have unions.
Thanks, Pete, for the call. Let's go next to Mike in West Bend. Mike, hello.
Thanks for taking my call. I'll make this short. I'm a progressive Democrat, very disappointed in this administration, terribly. We have an education system that does not push the trades. I'm retired union trades. We got a million, all kinds of apprenticeships open. Then you have a country that doesn't want to build anything. We have an administration that just wants to give out entitlements. And what irritates me is they tell these young kids, well, not everybody can be a dentist or a doctor, so why not be a plumber or a bricklayer? And a lot of these poor children, they got the talent. They don't get the guidance, and you have a whole system here. This country doesn't want to build anything anymore. And this, you talk about unions. Unions are great, but today's unions, they just give money to a political coffer to these people, these Democrats that sit in Washington, don't know what's going on the other side of the Potomac River, and do nothing.
Mike, thanks for the comments.
Yeah. I mean, Mike addresses a number of very good points, and one of them is about not building things. Why, if you had capital, would you invest in building something that might take from conception to completion 10 or 15 or 20 years when the rules allow you to just borrow a lot of money and go gamble on Wall Street in a market that has been rigged, as the book Flash Boys and others have pointed out? You have to get the incentives right and the government rules right to encourage investment in productive assets rather than unproductive assets.
Well, we really are right now. Government policy, not just tax policy, but up and down the line, encouraging speculation. It's like we're paying people to go to the casino, and if they lose, we pay them double.
Yep, absolutely, and. It is astonishing to the degree to which we're doing this. And unfortunately, President Obama is very closely connected with these people. Remember, he wanted to put Lawrence Summers in as head of the Federal Reserve. This was Lawrence Summers, who had a part of one day a week job on Wall Street that paid him over $5 million a year. Nothing that he was doing could possibly justify that salary except getting the connection to him and his influence. And it is a real problem, the degree of influence that Wall Street has, and it applies to both parties all over the place. Wall Street had taken all sorts of people, made them wealthy. Look at Mayor Rahm Emanuel in Chicago. Look at Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia. And these candidates, understandably, regardless of which party they're from, closely identify then with the interests of Wall Street.
Let's talk about unions for just a moment, since Mike brought that up. And you point out that union members, individual union members, are still doing fairly well. Here in Wisconsin, of course, we've seen public sector unions lose their clout. Do you think, do you foresee unions continuing to have any influence or any ability to maintain competitive wages and benefits for workers? And if so, how long are they going to be able to do this?
I think that the current U.S. Supreme Court, led by Chief Justice Roberts, is going to, at the earliest possible opportunity, make unions unworkable. The overwhelming drive by the people who are financing people like Governor Walker is to get rid of unions. They don't believe in unions. They believe unions are somehow bad and evil. My contention is they're market economics. They provide bargaining power. And on that, all I can say, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the founders of this country, Congress in 1792, President Washington, then Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, all were on the side that workers should collectively bargain and get a share of the profits. But I think unions are going to be in severe trouble under Justice Roberts. It's just a function of him getting the case. I mean, right now we're about to see the court take up a case in which one of the respondents arguing it has religious rights is a corporation. And that the court is even taking this case is astonishing. I mean, first of all, if you're a corporation, if you could pray, who would you pray to? Mammon? So unions, I think, are going to face increasing difficulty, John, unless we get a different Congress and different legislatures.
Let's take another call. This time it'll be Carolyn in Chippewa Falls. Carolyn, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to touch base a little bit on income equality and the fact that here in Wisconsin, at the university system, we have chancellors and vice chancellors getting 12% raises. our governor created and hired a new person named Jim Villa for $178,000 a year for public relations. And yet, we are laying off custodians and grounds crew people at UW-Superior who make from $11 to $13 an hour. So really, what do we value? That's my question.
Yeah, well, Caroline's hit upon a very important problem, and that is, and this really is sort of a class issue, this continued expansion at the top. If you look over time at both public and private universities, the big driving factor in tuition is not more full-time faculty. There's more and more part-time faculty and not well-paid, but larger administrations and huge salaries at the top and enormous diversions to sports. Rather than to education. There will be more and more difficulties over this as we try to drive down the wages of unskilled workers like custodians if they don't have unions.
Well, and in the bigger sense, income inequality, you even have, and I think this was, and I've been trying to find it all hour and I haven't been able to, it seems I was reading the CEO of Goldman Sachs, I think it was, pulling the alarm bell about income inequality and saying, hey, you know, it's time to start actually thinking about this because we've got a serious problem here. And when you get somebody like that from a big investment bank saying, well, wait a minute, maybe this isn't great that that just a few people get all the money. That was a little bit of an eye-opener for me. How can we what can be done to reverse this trend?
Well, the inequality that we're having in this country is not the result of nature. It is not the result of the bottom 90% deciding to just, you know, drink beer, smoke dope, and go to the beach. It is the result of government policies. In my best-selling trilogy on the economy, Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and the Fine Print, and on the book that I edited that just came out, Divided, the Perils of Our Growing Inequality, I try to show people how government policy is doing this. Trickle-down economics, a phrase that was invented to denigrate Ronald Reagan, got it wrong. It's not trickle-down. It's Niagara up. And until people, you know, understand that there are all these subtle rules at play, things like, you know, there's roughly a 1 in 3 chance when you go to a big box Walmart store that the sales tax that you pay is used to buy that store and the land underneath it, and that there are companies that derive all their profits now from subsidies from the taxpayers. The average American family of four is paying $900 a year just in state and local government subsidies to business, heavily tilted toward retail, which is the end of the economic chain. $900 a week is more than the take-home pay of the median income family of four in America. So a family of four in America typically works more than a week each year just to provide gifts of taxpayer money to corporations. We've got to stop this. But as long as people don't get organized, don't confront their politicians with facts, don't show up and vote, why this is going to continue? Why wouldn't it continue? Why wouldn't those people in a position to extract money from the government either directly or through policies that force you to do things that drain your pocket, why wouldn't they continue to do those? There's got to be pushback, and that requires work.
Well, it requires certainly a greater effort than has been expended thus far. One of the problems, don't you think, is that because this problem is complex, the solutions don't lend themselves very well to bumper stickers.
No, they don't. I mean, this is not – that's exactly right. I mean, I've spent the last 20 years of my life diving into this. I had no idea this is where I was going to end up 20 years ago. I mean, I totally didn't think this is it. But, you know, I and other people have done the work for people. Go get the books and learn how this happens and then pick an issue and organize with other people and go after it. But we shouldn't have an economy where people at the top – not all of them – but those who choose to can mine the economy. We should have an economy where we build and invest and create prosperity so that our liberties endure.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, David K. Johnston, for an interesting hour.
Thank you, John.
This program was produced by Cynthia Schuster, on-air production by Marika Suval and David Potratz. I'm John Munson. We'll talk more about the economy tomorrow afternoon at 2 when we discuss the book about an economic constitution. I'm John Munson, and for Kathleen Dunn, you're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned.